You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey, this is Ken Corsini with the Deal Farm. On today's Best Deal Ever episode, I've got Colm McCormick. Colm, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken. Good to hear your voice.
Man, thanks so much for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So Colm is out of Colorado Springs, Colorado. He is the owner of CNS Homes. He's been in real estate full time, really about, we just figured out, as long as I have. We both started about the same time, which was about May of 2005. So been at this a while. He's a wholesaler, retailer. He owns some rental properties. He does some fix and flips. He does a little bit of everything similar to us. And again, he's in the Pueblo, Colorado market. That's where he does the majority of his properties. But take us back, Colm. How did you get into real estate?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. My wife answered a late night infomercial.
Really? Hey, there's nothing wrong with that.
So, that ended up being a fraud, and we lost a ton of cash on it.
Oh, no.
Typically how it goes. But we just stuck to it, and we didn't quit, and we started closing deals slowly. We were able to pay off the credit card debt that we'd used to enter into that program, and we've been running the business debt-free, I would say, probably for several years now. Just try to pay cash for everything. We'll use a line of credit for fix and flips. But so I was working construction as a union carpenter, and we knew that my salary was capped at whatever I was making. And I also was, you know, it's hard work, and you get older, you probably put on 5 years for every year that you work when you're out in the field pouring concrete and swinging a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working with guys who looked 70 who were 50. And so we made a decision that we didn't want that lifestyle. Yes, there's risks of getting away from the IRA and the steady paycheck and the insurance benefits. But there's also rewards of, you know, not hurting my body and being able to do something long term into my retirement ages and to have an unlimited income. And sometimes that unlimited income is $0 per month, and sometimes it's $100,000 per month. So we took that risk and we stuck to it. We kept our hand to the plow and we didn't quit. There were many times where we could have quit, particularly when everything folded with that mentoring program we had purchased. But really, we're the ones who decide the outcome. If we quit, then we know, all right, that's the end, I failed. If we choose not to quit and carry on, we don't know what's going to happen. We could be successful. And I like to look back at my life to this point and say, you know, thank you, Lord, I'm successful.
Hmm. That's a good perspective. You know, it's funny. You're definitely not the first person I've talked to who got a rocky start to real estate and they stuck it out and they're glad that they did. I mean, a lot of people, you know, lose money on their first deal or in a bad investment and they sort of give up. They say, man, real estate's not for me, and they move on. So kudos to you for sticking it out.
So we flipped it around. We made money in our first deal, so we knew it worked. And then we like lost money. But because we had hit it on that first deal, we stuck it out. It was a little backwards. I don't know if we would have stuck it out if we lost on the first deal.
Okay. And so were you getting mentored or something? You bought into like a mentoring program and they were kind of helping you with the first couple deals?
Yeah, you know, so the first program was free. The second program was $3,000. And then the third program was $25,000.
Ooh, ouch.
And put it on credit cards. We had a mentor come into our town and be with us for 3 days. And so, yeah, that's how we did it. And so that was one chunk. And then the second chunk, that made me very active in my market. So that got my name out. And there's a very seasoned, great investor in my market who was seeing my emails, seeing me at the RIAs, seeing that I was becoming more active because I was in so deep on the other end with the mentoring program, that he asked me to come and work for him as his acquisitions person, as a buyer.
Okay.
And so I volunteered for a layoff at the construction company where I was a carpenter. And I went full time in the real estate, and I worked for him for about a year, year and a half as his acquisitions. And that second component was critical. That relationship taught me how to, some of the key principles that I was missing. One of those key principles was how to negotiate, how to use words to get the deal. And so what I learned there with that mentor really helped a lot. Now, quitting my job was a huge step, and joining him was a huge step. And it was great for me to join him, and it was great for me to leave him.
Sort of like your training ground, which, you know, that's the case with a lot of folks. They go work for somebody else, or they partner with somebody else, and they sort of learn the business first before they step out on their own.
Yep. And so I was fortunate that's the way it worked for me.
So principle one you learned from him was how to negotiate. What about principle two?
You don't change the target. If you know, you tell somebody that you're going to do something or you're going to pay them a certain amount of money, or you're going to manage them or buy their house or make their mortgage payment, don't change those targets on people. You have to set correct expectations, and you have to follow through as far as you're responsible to, you know, perform what you said you're going to do. I'd say a third thing I learned was how to structure a deal. So how do you put together a subject to deal with a rent to own? So you're entering a property on a subject to, but you're exiting property on a rent to own. And so the creative structuring of multiple entrance strategies linked with multiple exit strategies was something that I really learned during that year, year and a half with him.
Wow. It's huge having multiple tools in your tool belt to know how to make money on a deal and put it together. Because a lot of people walk away and they don't understand how to put it together. But you know, the more tools you have, the better equipped you are.
Yeah, I use that same analogy. And people often say, oh, you're a wholesaler. And I'm like, well, I'm an investor. And yes, I do a lot of wholesaling, but I also do rentals. I also do subject twos. I also do short sales. I also do fix and flips. I also do lease options. I also buy notes. I also foreclose on those notes. So I am an investor. And these, I tend to pull the wholesale tool out a lot, but I also have these other ones in there.
Yeah, that's huge. Well, the thing is, and we're the same way. I mean, we do a little bit of everything. And there's no two properties are alike. And some properties work from a wholesale standpoint, but sometimes they present themselves as just something completely different. And you have to know what to do with it and how to turn it into revenue.
Yep. And I've identified like a couple of tools that I haven't used in a few years. They're a little rusty in the bottom of the toolbox. I need to pull them out and sharpen them up. So like, I haven't done a lease option in a while. So I've got it here on my list to pull some lease option work out, get a couple of those seminars, and just kind of refresh my memory. And, you know, I'll throw that pitch sometime the next month, and I'll probably not get the deal, but I'm getting practice using that vocabulary and structuring that deal. And so, I mean, we always have to be educating ourselves, and that's our responsibility to do.
Yep. Man, that's great perspective too. Just sharpening your vocabulary in a certain area. Cause I'm the same way. I used to do it. We literally did like 70 lease purchases my first 2 years in the business. And that was my primary model, was lease purchases. And we got really good at it, but I haven't done one in maybe a year or two. And so to go back and kind of speak that language again and talk about all the benefits, I'd really have to sharpen up, I think, before I started having those conversations.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You're ahead of the game. If you can admit that and do it, you're ahead of your competition.
Yeah. So you left your construction job, joined forces with this local guy, worked for him for a year, and then eventually, what was the impetus to say, okay, I'm ready to step out on my own?
He kept changing my pay plan.
Okay, hence principle number two. He was changing your targets.
Yeah, he was changing my target. And so we just worked out an agreement to leave, and I used, you know, that time was another scary time. And but I did what I knew to do. I got a cell phone and 100 bandit signs, and I banged them up. And the phone calls would come in. I would go on the appointment, and I'd start signing contracts. And we kept our hand to the plow and didn't quit.
You know, it's funny. I literally just wrote down in my notebook bandit signs because I've got a literally warehouse sitting full of bandit signs that we keep forgetting to put up. But every time I have an interview, I'm reminded that they work, that people actually call on bandit signs. And
they
do. Was that your primary mode, I guess, of acquisitions with bandit signs before you did anything else?
Yes, it was.
Man,
so we would get the leads in. They were cheap. You know, you pick them up for $1 or something a sign, and then we would buy the stakes at a local store with some nails, and we go around and put them up, and we map them. And then as we got revenue, we got cash. Then I went into direct mail, and so now the bulk of our leads are coming from direct mail. And my box of bandit signs is sitting out in the backyard, just like yours are sitting in the garage or the shop.
Right.
And, you know, it's something that needs to be done. I need to get those bandit signs up because they work, and I haven't done that.
Yeah. So, but the same, it's tough because direct mail is just sometimes once you get it dialed in, it's so easy. It's just sort of you can put it on autopilot.
You nailed it.
Yeah. It's like you get lazy. You're just like, this is easy. I know I mail this many, I get this many calls, I get this many deals.
Yeah, that's funny that you should say that.
So let's talk about who you're mailing to. Are you mailing to like absentee, or do you have a special list?
Yeah, so I'll buy absentee list. I'll buy vacant list. We really didn't do very well with the foreclosure list. We would door knock foreclosures, and that seemed to work pretty well. We'll mail the expired list. We'll mail the farming list. So if we're out on an appointment, we'll keep an eye out for vacant abandoned houses. So those are some of the main lists that we mail to.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I've talked to anybody that's mailed to expired listings.
Yeah, we'll go back. I'm getting the agent to pull in the MLS anything that has expired 30 days ago. Going backwards 60 days. We want to get out of that 30-day hold open that listings usually have.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so we'll go back. Let's pretend this is the first of some month. Let's pretend it's the first of September. We'll go back to August 1st, all the way back into July, and into June, and into May. And all the listings that expired in those 3 months, we'll mail to for 3 or 4 months.
Oh, interesting. And you find that you're able to pop some deals from that list.
Once in a while. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not a big hit, but we get hits. Their motivation tends to be a little bit lower, but for the cost of it, it's good to keep it out there.
Sure, yeah. And so you guys did some door knocking as well? Because that's something we've even considered implementing, some really highly targeted lists, doing some door knocking or at least some door hangers. What did that look like for you guys?
The door hangers, we fell flat on our face. And then I got a tip from a friend of mine who was well seasoned, and we just started leaving a yellow post-it that said, "Hey, Bill, call me. Call him with my phone number." And Bill will call me up and say, "Who are you?" He'll know who you are. And I'd say, "Well, that's true. We've never met before, but I noticed that your house was in foreclosure a few months ago. I'm looking to buy a house for cash. Is that something you want to talk about, or probably not?" "No, I want to talk about that." And then you just go into your sales script. So we never got a response on the door hangers with the CDs or all the information about a modification or short sale. But a little post-it note, "Hey, Bill, call me." And then we'd map it out. We'd put it in the Magellan, and we'd route it. And we'd go on the route, and we'd just bang the notes on the doors. And each note would have the homeowner's name on it.
Interesting. And so this was like a pre-foreclosure? I guess this was not a – was it a pre-foreclosure list that you were working off of?
Yeah, so people in Colorado were a public trustee state. We're not a judicial foreclosure state. So in Colorado, they file with the public trustee, the lender, to do the foreclosure, and that becomes public notice 4 months prior to the auction date.
Wow, okay.
There's no redemption period right now in Colorado. So once that NED hits, that's the notice of election demand, we start mailing to it and we start door knocking it. And they would never call us off the door knock list. I mean, they'd never call us off the postcards, but they would call us when the yellow post-it hit the door, and I'd go to the appointment, and all my postcards would be sitting on the coffee table, along with everybody else's.
Yeah, you weren't the only one. But it's funny because they called because they didn't know what the heck the post-it note
for. Yeah, who are you?
What did I do? What do you need from me?
Yeah, exactly. Who are you? That's what they'd say.
Who are you? Yeah. That's hilarious, but it works. It gets the, that's really ultimately what you want. You just want the phone to ring so you can get on the phone with them and start talking.
Yeah, that's it. That was the key. And so once we got their phone number, then that was a big help.
Interesting. And yeah, so this is I'm sure been an evolving thing for you over the last so many years. I mean, every year it seems like, I'm not sure with you, but for me, it's different strategies work. Some years, you know, it's all MLS for us, or HUD Home Store, where now it's all off market and we're trying different things. But, you know, eventually everybody's doing the same thing. Everybody's sending yellow letters. Everybody's sending to the absentee list. And so you're sort of having to reinvent yourself. Do you find that from year to year, you're implementing new strategies?
So, we test that a lot, Ken. And so we'll send different types of postcards, or we'll do TV ads, or we'll do like, you know, investor in a can TV ads, where you basically buy a franchise right for your market.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do affiliate programs. So an affiliate is like a big web person who's just hitting the internet with sell your house fast and I buy their territory.
Gotcha.
And so we've had success with some of those, failures with others, billboards, bus benches. So yes, our rule of thumb is we'll test a new area for 3 months. We'll commit it to that marketing campaign for 3 months. And if it's not producing, we cut it and we'll do something else.
Yeah. That's interesting. You've tried a lot of different vehicles. What have you found? I mean, did the bus benches work? Because you always see the home investors do a lot of that, even the affiliate internet stuff. What did you find that's worked and what hasn't worked?
The basics work. Bandit signs work and postcards work. The referrals work. The magnet on the side of the truck works. I found that I'm always finding myself going back to the basics.
Interesting.
Just letting people know what we do. The other thing, so here's something simple that we started again this year, is follow-ups. We were taught this year to leave no lead behind. So we've implemented no lead left behind. And so no one is ever removed from the list unless they actually say, remove me from the list. And everybody gets an offer and everybody gets a phone call until infinity, until they say, stop calling me. So that's a simple thing that we are now trying this year. And we've closed, I would say, 4 or 5 deals from cold leads that were rotting in our CRM.
Interesting.
And I think the reason why that works is it goes back to the principle from my mentor. When I quit construction and joined this man and worked for him local market, he taught me something else. And that something else was time and circumstances change motivation. So if you are always in front of them for, say, 3 years, calling, texting, mailing letters, at some point in that 3 years, their circumstance will change or their time will change and they'll call you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, we don't do a fantastic job of follow-up. We're getting better at it, but we do put everybody on an email drip. And it is amazing to me how, you know, even on that like 7th or 8th month that they get that email, all of a sudden they respond for some reason. You know, like you said, yeah, their circumstance changed.
I do a monthly phone call with other investors for accountability. And so they say usually people won't respond until the 6th or 7th touch. So they, my friend on the call, he says, we hustle through those first 6 or 7 touches in about, you know, 8 weeks to get them out of the way, to get to the 9th, 10th touch when they respond. I thought that was an interesting perspective.
That is an interesting perspective. Go ahead and get the initial work out of the way because you know they're not going to sell to you. But
yeah, I don't necessarily buy into it because you need time between those touches for their circumstance to change.
Right, right. Yeah, there's nothing magical because you touched them 9 times.
That's correct, and you might just be a nuisance.
That's right, and you're just ticking them off. So now let me ask you this. So how are you – because your databases get big. I mean, you got thousands of names in there. How are you guys going back through and calling them? Is it you or do you have somebody you've hired?
We use a CRM that can handle that, and it has tasks within it that we set. So if I'm talking to a seller on the phone, I'm in the software working it, and I'm typing notes, and then I'll put a task, call them in 1 year,
mm-hmm.
call them in 6 months. And then every morning, the software sends me an email with a list of tasks I have to do today. And if it's a year later, that person would be in that list.
And so are you making the calls personally, or do you have a, like an acquisition person that does that?
The acquisition person, we're extending an offer to hire next week. We went through grueling, you know, month and a half. Well, it was grueling for them because we make them jump through a ton of hoops to make sure they're not going to quit on us. So I am transitioning, my business is transitioning from me making the calls and going on the appointments to an acquisitions sales representative to do that.
Gotcha. You know, I just talked to somebody that was doing something similar. They were calling all their old leads, and they actually had a VA in the Philippines that was working through their CRM making these calls. And it was like once a week or something crazy. And I just couldn't figure out how to make that a warm handoff. You know, having somebody in the Philippines talk to a potentially good lead, and because they're not going to be able to speak intelligently to them. I'm just not sure how that would work, but apparently they were having some success with it.
I've heard the same things, some people doing that, and I think if you have a lot of training. The other side of it, because we've got a whole stack of leads, like our postcards get returned. So when we return, when we get returned postcards, we do a skip trace on those postcards to see if we can't find contact information on the owner or their relatives. Then somebody starts calling through all that data to see if anything is valid.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we get a hit, then we do a sales call. So my thought on it is, if I'm paying the VA in the Philippines a minimal amount of money to make those calls, that's pretty affordable, nice, efficient way to do it.
Yeah.
But is it also affordable and efficient to have the acquisition sales rep do all that work? Because they're commission-based, so you're not paying them anything to work those leads.
True.
And so I'm going to bark up that tree for 3 months, and if it works, great. If it wears them out, and if it's not, if it takes their mojo from doing a sales call, it may be good money just to have the Philippines VA do it.
Yeah. I think the trick is just having a really good, tight script for your VA, and then having a transition, a smooth transition to one of your sales team members. Because you're right, calling all those.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
That's a lot of phone calls to make to probably get a lot of bad numbers and hang-ups and not interested.
Yeah, and if it's stealing the energy from the sales rep, that's not the highest and best use of their time.
Yeah. You know, almost, because it's funny, because I'm mulling these exact same things over right now in my business. I'm halfway wondering if it makes sense to just bring somebody in part-time after hours for minimum wage just to make these calls, just, you know, burn through, you know, 70 calls in an evening just to see, you know, if there's, because even when you skip trace them, you're going to have five numbers and maybe one of those numbers is the right number.
Bingo.
Yeah, that's a lot of numbers to call.
Bingo. And that's just for the homeowner. Now you also get the homeowner's neighbor, you get the homeowner's auntie, you get the homeowner's father.
Yeah.
And you got 5 or 10 numbers per lead. And yeah, if you were to get a college kid who came in and worked at nights, that might work.
Yeah. I kind of even thought about that here recently just for going back into our database and using them to try to warm up some of those cold leads just to see if there's any life out there.
Absolutely. And they could have a real simple script, and you can test verbiage to see, you know, I got a lot of hang-ups using this script, so let's change it.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's right. They cussed at me when I said this, so let me change it to this. Yeah.
No, that's a good tip. I'm going to have to think about that.
So what else is working for you in your business? Now, you guys are wholesaling a lot of what you're doing. Is that right?
Yep. Right now, the bulk of our business is wholesaling. We do a little bit of fix and flips and rentals as they come available.
Gotcha.
We cherry pick.
And are you selling mostly to local investors in Pueblo?
Yep. There'll be a little bit of out of town, a little bit out of state, but mostly local Pueblo investors. We wholesale to a lot of landlords. Great rental market in Pueblo.
Gotcha. Yep. Yep. So you get them cheap enough, and they can come in there and get a nice, solid return on a buy and hold deal. How have you built your buyers list over the years?
I'll go to the foreclosure sales, and I'll observe who is paying cash for houses, and then I'll approach them after the sale. Or if I miss them, I'll call the public trustee, and they're obliged to give me the name and phone number of whoever bought the house. I'll go to the RIAs, and I'll network with other investors. We can get elaborate as well and have somebody do a search for everybody who paid cash for houses in the past year, and now you're building your wholesale list.
Yep. Yep. Just slow and steady. That's the way to do it. I mean, just one after the next.
Yeah,
keep adding
that's
them.
A good way. I coasted for a while and I didn't add anybody. And I was realizing, you know what? You got to keep the list refreshed. There's people coming and going in this business.
Absolutely. Yep. It's good to have a system in place. We've done the same. We've coasted for a while and it's just, you have to keep adding because some people tap out. You know, you might have a buyer that's buying for a while and then he stops because he's got enough. And there's always new investors coming in.
Or he goes
into
bankruptcy, he bought too much.
That's right. He came to his senses. What did I do? That's funny. Okay, so you've been at this 10 years just like me. You've done a lot of different deals, a lot of creative stuff. Is there one deal that stands out to you now as your best deal ever?
So, I mean, I would say 1.5. How's that?
Okay, that sounds good.
We were doing we got a phone call on a property. It was a 4-bedroom, 2-bath rancher with a finished basement on some land with a well on it and also municipal water. It had two water sources. In Colorado, water is more valuable than gold.
Hmm.
So she approached us about 2 weeks prior to the foreclosure sale. So we submitted an offer to the lender that was just like a couple of $1,000s below the payoff.
Mm-hmm.
It was over leveraged. That was above a retail price. We submitted the offer to draw a postponement of the foreclosure sale, which we got. They went ahead and put the foreclosure on hold and ordered an appraisal. And then the appraisal was done, and then we resubmitted the offer with an amend extend down to what we could buy it for at a wholesale price. And the appraisal came in at our offer price, and we were able to purchase the property at that price. So when we had the approval of the short sale from the lender, we started marketing to our buyers. And I marked it up, I think it was like $22,000, $25,000, thinking I'll never get that. But there was a guy out there in the neighborhood who wanted to have that house because it had that well on it. And so he said, whatever you want, I'll pay for it. So we marked it up that much, and we did a simultaneous closing. Now, this was back before the arm's length transaction disclosures that lenders were issuing. So we were allowed to do simultaneous and double closings.
I was about to say, for all those people listening, it's almost impossible to do a SIMO on a short sale these days with all the different affidavits and arm's length things that you're signing.
Yeah, it's pretty much if you do one nowadays, you're breaking a contract agreement.
Yeah.
And it was also well before a lot of state laws in Colorado were enacted. So it was back when things were great.
Yeah, right. Things were like Wild West, man.
But then they figured out what we were doing and they changed the rules.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, we abided by all our contracts and state laws, and we did a double closing and made $25,000 for really knowing what the unwritten rules of the game were. You know, offer high, draw a postponement, adjust your price, market it out there.
That's really interesting. So that you got them to stop the foreclosure because you gave them a reasonable offer, but then when you started down the process with them, you actually came in at a lower price.
Yeah, because everybody is allowed to do an inspection within our, and we abided by our deadlines, and we put the amend extend in on time, and we just knew the rules that aren't written down.
Heck yeah.
So, and then I would say real quick, the other one, we had been marketing to this house. This actually happened this year. We were marketing to this house in foreclosure, and the guy never returned our phone call. He never returned the call with the posting note on the door. And we bought the house at the foreclosure sale when it auctioned. So we went to the sale and we purchased it. And I went over to the house and was knocking it around and knocking on the doors with my realtor. And I climbed through the back window and I said, hey, is there anybody here? And he said, yeah, I'm here. And I said, meet me out front. So he met me out front And he said, what do you want? I said, I bought the house today at the foreclosure sale. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, it got foreclosed on. You don't own this house anymore. I do. Actually, I said, the company I work for does. They sent me over here to talk to you about
it. There you go.
And he's like, that can't be. And I was like, no, look, here. And I showed him, you know, my certificate of purchase. And the poor guy was pretty shooken up. And again, my postcards are in his house. My post-it note was on his door, and he never responded. But he responded after it was sold. Long
late.
And short of it, his mother lives in Ohio, and she calls me up and says, how much do you want? And I told her, I said, I got to have at least 15 grand over what I purchased it for. So she wires me the 15 grand into my account. I sign a special warranty deed and meet the fella at the courthouse, and he records it. So he gets his mom gets the house back. He doesn't have to move. Okay.
Uh-huh.
I get 15 grand for just showing up at the auction and buying it. And the kicker is, so he owed about $145,000 on the house. I picked the house up for about $100.
Okay.
The house is worth about $145. The mom paid me $115 plus some wire transfer fees. He's into his mom, basically. He's into the house for about $115,000, $116,000, and it's worth $145,000. He came out with equity.
That's crazy.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And when I explained it to him, he was like, holy cow. I said, man, other than chanking your credit, you getting foreclosed on and me buying your house is probably one of the best things that happened to you with this house. You're into it with equity. You didn't have to lose the house. You got rid of that toxic mortgage. I got a profit, and your poor mother will probably never see that $115,000.
Well, I was going to say, the only person that lost this deal sounds like his mother.
Well, I don't know why she did it. And I was like, listen, are you sure you want to bail out your adult son? Dude, he couldn't be missing out on an important life lesson here at 55.
Yeah, I think the only lesson he learned is foreclosures work out great.
Yeah, man, he's going to do that again.
This is fantastic. That's crazy.
So those are two cool deals that I'm grateful to the Lord to have gone through.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's hilarious. I mean, I love real estate stories like this because they're so unique. Everyone's so different. I've never heard one where you foreclosed, kept the guy in it, and he actually reduced his mortgage amount. That's pretty crazy.
I was so happy about that. I mean, I was happy with my profit. I mean,
sure.
I pushed paper for, I think, a couple of days.
Yeah, heck, 15 grand for a quick turn like that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think the only loser in that transaction was his poor mom.
It was. She's a really nice lady. She wrote me a great testimonial.
Oh, that's great. Good stories. All right, Colm. So tell us, where can people find you? If they're interested in learning about real estate in Pueblo, Colorado, where would they find you?
So, we are based in Pueblo, Colorado. Well, we're not based there. That's where we do all our business. We're at cnshomes.com. That's Colm and Susie is my wife. And is spelled out cnshomes.com. Pueblo, if you're looking for rental properties that have low purchase price, I'm talking $28,000 in rent for $650 a month.
Wow.
So you're getting incredible
ROI.
Pueblo is a way to do that. That's a great market to do that in. These are probably C and B houses. They're not A houses. You know, we've got a great rental portfolio down there.
Interesting. So these are bought $25,000 livable, or are you putting money on top of that?
A little bit of both. I'm selling one tomorrow. That's an assignment. I bought it for $12,500 from this homeowner, and I'm assigning it to a local investor for $22,400.
Okay.
And he's into it at 50% loan to value. We signed up another house 2 days ago for $8,000. That's a two bedroom, one bath that needs carpet paint and a furnace. And that's worth about $45,000. That first house I told you about, that one is move in ready. It has new roof, new stucco, new furnace, new hot water heater. The systems are all great. It even has a grassed lawn in the back. So that one will go for about the same, $650.
Man, that's strong. That's really strong. You have a strong property management company down there?
So Pueblo is a little weak in that. So unfortunately, I find myself kind of managing the managers, but there are some who are worse than others.
Yeah.
So the ones we're using right now, they don't fill them great, but they really manage them and take care of the resident and the property great. Once it's filled, they really do well on that. They're a little tardy on filling it, so.
Gotcha, gotcha. That's still, those numbers are ridiculously strong. 25K purchase,
yep,
600
great,
rent.
Yeah, it's a great landlord's market.
Yeah, killer. Awesome. Well, Colin, man, thanks so much for being on the show. This is super informative.
Absolutely. I appreciate you inviting me.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Have a great day.
Hey, Deal Farm Podcast listeners, this is Ken Corsini with a special offer. If you go to our website right now, dealfarm.net, you have the ability to download our new blueprint. It's called 30 Days to 10K. It's basically the exact blueprint you need to start profiting from wholesaling real estate right now. It's the resources, it's the websites, it's the services that we use. I've even included my exact postcard that I send out. Basically everything you need to start getting deals in the next 30 days. Again, it's at our website, dealfarm.net. Check it out, you can download it for free. Also, we still have our free t-shirt offer. If you want a free Deal Farm Podcast t-shirt, just subscribe through iTunes to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating, and then go through our website, contact us, give us your name, address, and t-shirt size, and we will send you a t-shirt in the mail immediately. As always, thanks so much for listening to The Deal Farm. We'll see you on the next episode. Take care.